This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House announced today that Israel agreed to daily four-hour pauses of military operations in Gaza to allow for civilians to leave the area and humanitarian aid to come in. This comes after a week of debate about how to de-escalate the war, with the Biden administration supporting what are called humanitarian pauses. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking at a press conference yesterday.
We had in-depth discussions about the steps that we are taking to address urgent needs on the ground. We all agreed that humanitarian pauses would advance key objectives to protect Palestinian civilians, to increase the sustained flow of humanitarian assistance, to allow our citizens and foreign nationals to exit, and to facilitate the release of hostages. I briefed my colleagues about my conversations with Israeli leaders on pauses and on concrete steps to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians in Gaza and to stop extremist violence in the West Bank.
The Biden administration hasn't pursued a ceasefire, but the United Nations, many world leaders, peace activists, and policy experts are urging that the fighting stop altogether. Our next guest has joined the call for an immediate ceasefire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the Biden administration's support of this idea of humanitarian pauses in the conflict? Do you think the situation calls for a ceasefire? Do you have questions for our guest about what the difference is and about some of the deeper issues underlying the conflict? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. militarism, and U.N. issues. She's the author or editor of 11 books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, and serves as the international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. Phyllis, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Now, first of all, what's your reaction today to this, at least, announcement from the White House about Israel agreeing to temporary humanitarian pauses? I understand we haven't heard a confirmation of that from Israeli leaders?
We have not heard a confirmation, and we haven't seen any halt in the bombing. The humanitarian need on the ground, the urgent need, is to stop the bombing. The idea of a humanitarian pause is better than not having it for, they're talking about 1 or 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. But the reality is that it's not enough, and as soon as that pause ends, the bombing resumes and the killing resumes. So we're now seeing, according to Save the Children, one child is killed by Israeli bombing every 10 minutes. Every 10 minutes. So will this mean that they're only being killed every 11 minutes? If so, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's why we're needing a ceasefire that stops the bombing, period, full stop. And let's be clear, we're talking about a bilateral ceasefire. So that means Hamas also stops sending these rockets of various sorts into Israel. Luckily, none of them are hitting anything. Nobody has been killed by them, luckily. But they are still illegal, and they should be stopped as well. But the bombs that are killing people are the Israeli bombs, and they need to stop.
The argument from Israel is that a ceasefire would help Hamas regroup and maybe renew terrorist attacks on Israel itself. What are your thoughts on, first of all, Israeli resistance to the idea of a ceasefire?
You know, this notion that a ceasefire only helps Hamas really sort of begs the question of, what do you think about how much it helps the children of Gaza who might get to live? You know, nobody ever talks about that. It's always, well, will it help Hamas more or will it help Israel more? It's going right to the question of what happens to the fighters, not what happens to the victims, to the people who are doing the dying. That's why we say that there's a need for a ceasefire. That's why the Pope called for a ceasefire. That's why the Secretary General of the United Nations is calling for a ceasefire. That's why governments around the world, not only in the Global South, although clearly more strongly there, today even President Macron in France announced his support for a ceasefire. The U.S. is increasingly isolated on this question. And, you know, we should be clear about this question of what's the role of the U.S. We've been hearing, there was a big piece in the New York Times today, another one in the Washington Post, about how the Biden administration and Biden himself are upset about the lack of Israeli collaboration with what the U.S. is requesting. And I'm sitting there thinking, Why should they collaborate? Why should they agree? Because all the U.S. is doing is issuing very polite, mild requests. Please stop bombing. And Netanyahu says, no. And then the answer is, okay, and we'll go on to talk about something else. They're not going to stop the bombing. They're not going to issue a ceasefire. They don't want to, clearly. But part of it is the U.S. is not imposing any consequences for their refusal. So if Biden went to Israel or called him on the phone and said, hey, Bibi, you got to stop the bombing. You got to stop the killing. And Netanyahu said, no. Then the answer is, okay, you're supposed to be an independent country. You can do what you want. But you know the rest of that $4 billion that we send you every year, that some of it's still in the pipeline, the weapons and the cash, you can kiss that goodbye. And you know the other $14 billion we're trying to get Congress to agree to send to you? That's not going to happen. And you know how we've always protected you so that you're never held accountable at the International Criminal Court for the actions that you're taking that violate all kinds of international law, from the Geneva Conventions to the Convention Against Genocide? We're not going to protect you anymore. I think we'd start to see a very different answer from the Israelis very quickly.
Talking to Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies about calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Phyllis, you've written recently about what you hope would come after a ceasefire, and that you say is a look at some of the underlying causes, the long-running causes of these conflicts in the first place. What kind of things would you like to see the U.S. talking about, the international community talking about, and of course, Israelis and Palestinians talking about?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that. It's very difficult to talk these days about root causes, because the idea of talking about root causes is somehow being equated to giving credence or even supporting the horrific acts that Hamas carried out on October 7th, as if understanding why things happen is the same thing as supporting them or something. The reality is our understanding of history always starts with when you start the clock. If you start the clock on October 7th, you see as your first thing these horrific attacks from Hamas against 1,400 people who were killed, about 335 of whom were military. The rest were civilians, mostly Israelis, not all, a lot of internationals as well. And you don't ever get to see why something like that would happen. If you don't understand why it happened, it's almost impossible to imagine what it would take to make it stop, to make sure it never happens again. So if you don't understand that the horrific violence that we saw explode on October 7th didn't, as Secretary General of the UN, Guterres put it, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It was rooted in decades of occupation, 16 years of a brutal siege of Gaza, collective punishment, all kinds of violations of international law and the laws of war. You know, this is now the sixth attack. It's of a whole different scale. It's hugely more punishing, killing far more people and lasting longer than earlier Israeli assaults on Gaza. But those assaults are not new. The first one was in 2008 and 9, what was called Operation Cast Lead. And then there was another in 2012 and another very big one in 2014 that left 2,200 Palestinians dead. There was another one in 2018. And then there was another in 2021, just a couple of years ago. We didn't hear this kind of outrage when Palestinians were attacked with Israeli initiative, without any claim that something right then had happened that required it. The Israeli position, still until now, as far as I know, but what they always used to talk about at the official level, this is not just some media headline, but in the Knesset, this is called mowing the grass. It was the notion that every couple of years, you have to remind the people of Gaza who's really in control. And you do that by bombing. You do that by imposing an even more crippling siege. You know, one of the things that I hadn't known about the siege of Gaza that began in 2007, it's been a siege now for more than 16 years. And we're hearing now about this brutal siege that has cut off all access to food, water, fuel, electricity, all the things that make life possible in this isolated area. But the siege that's been underway now for 16 years, one of the impacts of it that I had never known, I thought I knew a lot about the impact, the humanitarian impact of the siege, but I didn't know this. It turns out that as of January of this year, way before this current crisis, the siege impact was so bad that 20% of the children of Gaza were stunted before the age of 2, because there simply is not sufficient good food. None of it had protein. They had no access to fresh vegetables, no access to fruit. Often milk was in short supply and baby formula. And the result was 20%, one out of every 5 babies, was stunted in Gaza for the last 16 years. And this is one of those stunning factoids that you never think about until suddenly you do. And you realize how devastating that is for a whole generation of people who are going to grow up in Gaza, those who survive this. We now know from Save the Children that one child is dying every 10 minutes under the bombs. This is the impact of the siege that's been underway since 2007, 16 years. Imagine how many children have now been affected by that.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Appleton. Robert, hi.
Yeah, you know, nobody supports what Hamas did. They went out across the border with the intention of committing horrible atrocities, and they certainly did. However, you also have to acknowledge the reality that one of the reasons why there's this siege that is stunting children is that Hamas has always, since the day they took over in Gaza, said they're committed to the entire destruction of the state of Israel and the death of every Israeli citizen. You also have to keep in mind that Hamas has put legitimate military targets where they will do the absolute most damage to civilians, underneath hospitals, underneath refugee camps. Hamas has fired on Israeli troops that were trying to clear a path to help the people in Gaza to get out to Egypt. And let's be clear, nobody has clean hands in this conflict. 3 of the prime ministers of Israel were members of the Irgun gang, who carried out atrocities and human rights offenses that are right up there with anything that the Palestinians have ever done. They blew up the King David Hotel full of British soldiers who were there in a hospital.
Robert, thanks for the call, Phyllis.
Robert is absolutely right. And we can look at just a few days ago when the current president of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, called for a holy war against Gaza. And he based it on the biblical story of the Israelites being ordered by God to annihilate the Amaleks for revenge, for vengeance, not for justice, for vengeance. You know, these stories that you can find arguments for whatever you want in the Bible. I guess that's true. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I know a little bit. And I heard about this one, and then I followed up on it to see what he actually said. And yeah, the story of the Amaleks reminded me of our own country, where you had, during what were known as the Indian Wars in the 19th century, many of them, the generals, many of them were ministers. And they were the ones who used the language about killing children. And in one example, in the Sand Creek Massacre, the general ordered his troops to attack a peaceful sleeping village of indigenous people on the banks of a river. And some of his own soldiers came and said, wait, these are children. These are babies and women. And he said, kill them all. Nits make lice. And that became the theme song, the meme, if you will, 200 years ago, of what these wars were about, killing the children because they would grow up to be the people we wanted to get rid of. And this is the same thing we're seeing now. And yes, it goes back to the early founding of the Zionist movement. There's a long history of Zionist terror that was crucial in creating the state of Israel, in expelling the 750,000 Palestinians who were kicked out. And yes, what Hamas is doing, as I said right at the beginning, maybe you missed it, Robert, is that what Hamas did on October 7th was in complete violation of international law, and they should be held accountable. What international law does not allow is two things in this case. One is no one who's carrying out a war, including a war that might be legal, no one is allowed to attack civilians, to issue collective punishment in its war, to refuse to distinguish between civilian and military targets, all of which Israel is doing right now. And on the other hand, what Hamas did also targeted both military and civilian targets. The majority of the people who were killed were indeed civilians. That is also illegal. There is a difference. Both sides are prohibited from attacking civilians. Period. Full stop.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Phyllis Bennis is with us at the Institute for Policy Studies, looking at the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. She's calling for a ceasefire there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, looking at Israel, Hamas, and Gaza, the Biden administration's Middle East policy, and increasing calls for a ceasefire. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Middleton. Matt, hi.
Hello. Kind of following up on what Rob said previously, I don't think there's going to be any end to this tit for tat until, as Israel said, Hamas is gone. And what does that mean? To me, that means that the entire Gaza Strip is occupied by Israel, the government's replaced, and the Gaza Strip becomes either a province that either is self-governing or has an oversight to it until such time as terrorist organizations aren't being elected by the people. We did the same thing during World War II when Germany was conquered. We replaced the government with one that was drawn up by the Allies. There was a government that was voted on, and there was supervision for the next two or three decades.
Matt, thanks for the call. To clarify, Rob, he was talking about Rob the caller, not Rob the host. Phyllis, your thoughts on Matt's idea there.
Yeah, I suppose that Matt was also a fan of the Iraq War, because that's just what we did there, too. And how'd that go for us? You know, we overthrew the government, dismantled the army, and imposed a government that we thought was going to be democratic. And then we even went through the motions of having democracy. For 20 years, we were at war. I don't think that's going to work. I think that what we need is a ceasefire to stop the violence and then look at the root causes, which have to do with the longstanding occupation and theft of land, which has characterized the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians since 1947-48. I think that what the Biden administration is doing region-wide right now, sending a nuclear-powered and a nuclear-capable, nuclear-weapons-capable submarine to the region, sending two aircraft carrier groups with hundreds, it means about 150 warplanes, another 1,000 troops, bringing to a total of 45,000 U.S. troops in the region, special forces that were just sent in. That's not going to reduce regional tensions, which is what we're being told. It's going to ratchet up the regional tensions. That's why we need a ceasefire.
Thanks for the call. Jan joins us now in Wisconsin. Jan, hi. Are you there, Jan? Not hearing Jan, but Jan was wondering about what's going on in the West Bank with a lot of focus on Gaza. There is also violence in the West Bank. What are you watching for there, Phyllis?
Yeah, the level of violence has escalated massively in the last year, and especially in this last month when, as you say, all eyes have been on Gaza. The far-right extremist government that the Israelis elected, we're talking about elections here, that they elected, have, among other things, brought the majority of the Israeli soldiers, including those that had been deployed around the Gaza Strip, to the West Bank to protect settlers while they carry out what amount to pogroms against Palestinian cities and towns and villages. Two more Bedouin villages have just had their whole set of homes destroyed and their villages ended, essentially just wiped out in settler attacks. There was another attack today in Jenin refugee camp that left 10 Palestinians dead. I don't know how many were injured. I just got the news a couple of hours ago. So the level of violence, the olive trees that are being uprooted, Palestinians being arrested in huge numbers, there's now an additional 5,000 Palestinians that have been arrested just this month from the West Bank and are being held almost entirely on the basis of what they call administrative detention in military prisons, where they can be held for 6 months without any charges being filed, without having the right to see their charges, because there are none, with their lawyers having no information about why they're being held. And when the 6 months is up, they can be held for another 6 months, and that can go on, as it is going on in some cases, for years. And of those 1,200 or so administrative detention prisoners, 120 of them are children, because only Israel has a juvenile military detention system. It's the only country in the world that brings children as young as 12. That's when it starts in the West Bank, when you become eligible to be arrested by the military, held and interrogated by the military, imprisoned by the military, and then sentenced by a military judge for a 12-year-old child. Imagine that. So that's what we're looking at right now in the West Bank. And that situation is absolutely explosive. More than 130 Palestinians, that was before the 10 today, so it's now at least 140 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in this last month. So the situation there is very, very dangerous for Palestinians, increasingly so.
Phyllis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project. She's the author of several books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, serves as the international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. She joined us for a look at what's happening in the Israel-Hamas war, including today's announcement that Israel has agreed to humanitarian pauses, that announcement from the White House, why she and others are calling for a ceasefire. You can follow the various conversations we've had about Gaza here on the Ideas Network and NPR coverage over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, answering a listener request, Kate and her guests tackle the issue of problem gambling here in Wisconsin and what help might be out there and available. Join that conversation coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Food and Drug Administration last week issued warnings for over 24 brands of over-the-counter eye drops after finding unsanitary manufacturing conditions leading to risks of infection and vision loss. A similar problem happened earlier this year when several other eye drop brands were recalled after contamination concerns and at least 5 cases of permanent vision loss and 1 death. There have been over 14,000 drug recalls in the last 10 years. That number includes prescriptions as well as these over-the-counter medications. Drug recalls happen not just because of contamination, but for a variety of other potential causes. Our next guest says that's just one concern when it comes to over-the-counter medication. She says we also need to think about drug interactions when we get medicine off the shelf. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have to throw out a bottle of eye drops after this recall? Have you been affected by drug recalls in the past? Do you have questions about safety when it comes to over-the-counter drugs, both in terms of the quality assurance process, but also what we take them with, the impacts they can have on us? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Michelle Chui is professor and chair of social and administrative sciences, director of the Sonderegger Research Center for Improved Medication Outcomes, and head of the Chui Systems Approach to Medication Safety Lab at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm really happy to be here today.
Let's start with these drug recalls, whether it's prescription or over-the-counter medication. When we see a recall, should we feel like, oh no, the system failed, or oh no, or oh great, the system worked and caught a problem, or maybe a little bit of both?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. You know, recalls are kind of a scary thing. You know, we expect our drugs to be safe, and we expect that when we get them at the prescription or an OTC product at the pharmacy, that they'll be safe for us to use and that we can take them as directed by our doctor or by our pharmacist. So I can see how a recall could be kind of a scary thing. But the recall process is actually a great regulatory process that the FDA has in place. The purpose of the recall is to identify very quickly when there might be a problem with the medication, whether it's contamination or some other issue, as you had previously stated. And it's an opportunity to broadcast out to healthcare professionals and patients and caregivers that there might be something wrong, and to seek out more information so that you can determine whether or not that product is safe for you or not. So it's a great opportunity to identify the potential for harm before harm takes place.
So with these eye drop recalls, for example, can you talk through the process? What triggers the FDA to look more closely at these products and then to go to the step of issuing this recall?
Yeah, so the FDA has very stringent guidelines for manufacturer of medications. They have quite a list of policies and procedures associated with maintenance of the facilities. They spot check the medications and the batches that they are manufacturing. And if there ends up looking like there could be a problem, then they will call out to the other manufacturers to ensure that there's no other problem in place. And in this case, most recently, there was bacteria contamination in the eye drop. That's a scary thing because you're putting this, you know, the liquid into your eye and you don't want your eye to be infected. And so an opportunity existed where they called out to the other manufacturers of eye products, and those products were also tested. And as a result, it was identified that we needed to recall these products. And that's how the consumers found out about it and were able to take them off the shelf, talk to their physicians and their pharmacists to identify whether or not those products should be trashed and then purchasing new products again. So it's a good way to get more information and to ensure that the products that you are taking continue to be safe.
Now, there's a global supply chain for many products. Over-the-counter medications is part of that. A lot of our drugs come from, say, Mexico, India, China. Does that make it complicated to track manufacturing, given that it's not just within our borders here?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So when products are sold in the United States, regardless of where they are manufactured, they have to follow the U.S. manufacturer guidelines. So any product that is sold in the United States, if it's a prescription product or an OTC product that is sold in the United States, must adhere to the manufacturer guidelines that the FDA prescribes. So there should be no difference in the manufacturing and the safe practices, whether the product is manufactured in China, Europe, or in the United States.
Now, if a consumer hears something about a recall, they might wonder, well, wait, how do I make sure that I don't have the recalled product in my medicine cabinet? I'm looking at the FDA's drug recall page. Is that the best way for people to find out, or how do consumers know if their product is covered by a recall?
Yeah, great question. So the easiest way to identify whether or not a product is recalled is to call your pharmacist. Your pharmacist should be your one-stop shop to give you the type of information that you need for both prescriptions or OTCs. All of the products have a lot number on them, and that is the number that you would identify to determine whether or not your specific product is recalled. But that's, you know, there's numbers and letters. It's kind of complicated to sort through when you go to the FDA website. So the easiest place to go to would be to just check in with your pharmacist. You can send them a picture or take your product into the pharmacy, and they would be very happy to help you determine whether or not that product is recalled, and then help you identify a new product if you need to purchase a different product.
We are talking about over-the-counter medications and safety, both when it comes to recalls, as the FDA recalled some eye drops. And we're also now going to get into drug interactions we should watch for. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences maybe with a recall or with taking an OTC over-the-counter product that turned out to have bad effects because of something else you were taking. Michelle Chui stays with us from the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Michelle, I know you do a lot of work on over-the-counter medications and how they interact with other drugs, especially for seniors. And I think a lot of us in the United States take over-the-counter medications, not quite like they were candy, but pretty darn close. What kind of things should we watch for to make sure that that medication we're buying off the shelf doesn't have consequences, doesn't interact with other stuff we take?
Yeah, so great question, Rob. I just wanted to say again that, you know, over-the-counter medications are indeed medications. Too much is not good. And particularly for older adults who take a lot of prescription medication, there are over-the-counter medications that can interact with them. Even the use of over-the-counter medications, if you take them too often, for too long, or too many at a time, can also pose a risk. Some of the over-the-counter medications that you can take can make you at risk of drowsiness, confusion, falling. And we don't want any of our older adults to be at risk of falling, because we all want them to be able to live in their homes, happy in their homes. And we want to prevent emergency department visits, hospitalizations, and nursing home admissions. So older adults represent 13% of the U.S. population, but they account for 62% of adverse drug events associated with emergency department visits. So this is an important topic. We want to make sure that older adults in particular are safe with the over-the-counter medications that they take.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I am calling about the usage of a drug called diphenhydramine. For many years, I've been taking that to go to sleep at night, although I believe that it is most usually sold for people who have allergies. And what I'm thinking is that because it's sold to dry up your sinuses for allergy sufferers, I am wondering if there's a possibility that this is also drying up hair follicles, causing hair loss, drying up cilia in your cochlea, causing deafness, and also drying up vocal cords, which is the reason I think that I sound the way I do. So how detrimental to your health is the taking of diphenhydramine? The dosage on the bottle says take two, and I usually take a half of one.
Nancy, thanks for the call. I want to get into a bigger issue on diphenhydramine with you in a minute, Michelle. But first of all, Nancy's specific question about dryness resulting from diphenhydramine, brand name Benadryl, often found in your PM sleep type products as well.
Yeah, great question, Nancy. You are so right. Diphenhydramine, brand name Benadryl, is typically used for allergy meds to dry you up when you have a runny nose. It's also in a lot of cough and cold products. Actually, diphenhydramine is in a lot of over-the-counter products, both pain products, cough cold products, and sleep products. So it does do a good job of drying out your runny nose. It also is prone to drowsiness. I will say that there is no evidence for drying of those other issues that you had. And I think that Rob is going to talk about diphenhydramine some more. So I'll just stop there.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Yeah, and Michelle, this is a bit of a coincidence. My folks just did an online lecture from University of Michigan. Their sleep people raised very serious concerns for seniors using diphenhydramine as a sleep aid, as you were mentioning earlier, in part because of risks of falls and drowsiness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So diphenhydramine is a product that has something called an anticholinergic effect. And that's a big word, but what that means is that drugs that have an anticholinergic effect can be at risk of causing you to be drowsy. It could cause you to be confused in older adults, and it could mask other symptoms that could look like dementia, but really are not dementia. So for older adults, it's very, very clear. And there's a lot of evidence that diphenhydramine should not be used in older adults. Many adults use them when they're younger and they continue using them as they get older. But pretty much after you turn 65 or so, when your body starts to change, you're taking a lot more prescription medications that also could have anticholinergic effects. It's a clear recommendation that older adults should no longer be taking diphenhydramine.
Nancy, thanks again for that call. I don't know your age. I'm not a doctor, but maybe look into other sleep options, it sounds like. Michelle Chui is professor and chair of social and administrative sciences, head of the Chui Systems Approach to Medication Safety Lab at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. We're talking about over-the-counter medication safety, both with some recalls in the news, in this case of eye drops, and wider issues of possible drug interactions for everybody, especially for seniors when we take these OTC medications. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about drug recalls? Have you had to search that medication shelf to see if one of your medications was covered? Do you have questions or thoughts or maybe experiences with drug interactions for those products you buy off the pharmacy shelf? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Michelle Chewy, professor and chair of social and administrative sciences at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. We're talking about over-the-counter drug safety, both when recalls happen, as is going on right now with some brands of eye drops, and drug interactions, especially for seniors. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever talked to a doctor about whether you can take an over-the-counter medication and possible interactions with a prescription medication? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michelle, let's put ourselves in the position of maybe a senior, an older person who's taking one, two, three prescription medications, wondering if they can take this pain reliever, that sleep aid, that allergy medication, whatever, that they can buy off the shelf. What do you recommend they do? What kind of conversations should they have with healthcare providers to see how that's going to fit in with those other medications?
Great. So the first thing I would recommend is that older adults in particular carry a list of their prescription and OTC medications with them. You could laminate a little card for your wallet or put a little piece of paper in your purse so that anytime there's a question from a provider or a pharmacist, you can just whip that piece of paper out and go through the list of medications with them. It's really hard to remember all of the medications that you're on. Sometimes the names are very complicated, difficult to pronounce. So it's always great to have a current list of your medications with you. The second thing I would do is anytime you're not sure about taking an over-the-counter medication for pain, or maybe, you know, it's cough and cold season right now, so you need to get something for a stuffy nose or a runny nose or a cough, the best idea would be for you to go and talk to a pharmacist in a community pharmacy. The community pharmacist is the drug expert, and they are available all of their open hours to help you. Now, right now, I know pharmacists tend to be really busy, but you should ask questions, and you should demand to get some help related to your medications, because, you know, taking a new medication, even an OTC medication, is serious business. We don't want you to be harmed. We don't want you to have a side effect. And the best way to identify that is to talk to a pharmacist about it and ensure that the medication that they select for you doesn't interact with any of the drugs that you're already taking or any of the disease states that you might have.
Now, we've been talking about prescription medications and over-the-counter medications. Let's throw in another category, supplements, which covers a lot of ground. People might not even think of them as potentially interacting with medications. Is that a concern, though?
Absolutely. Supplements are definitely a concern. There's a possibility of overdosing on things like vitamins as well. Just because something is good for you doesn't mean that two times, three times, five times of those things is even better for you. So everything in moderation, follow the directions, or again, most importantly, talk to your healthcare professional, and of course, the pharmacist is the most accessible person for you.
Talking to Michelle Chewy, professor and chair of social and administrative sciences, head of the Chewy Systems Approach to Medication Safety Lab at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. You can join in with your questions about over-the-counter medications and safety when it comes to recalls, if you've experienced something like that, or if you've done that, made that checklist of medications and had a talk with a doctor or pharmacist about possible interactions, or if you are that doctor or pharmacist, love to hear your perspective as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Laura now in Ashland. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I just turned 62, and you were talking about Benadryl and how that's not necessarily good for older people, and I know you said 65, to take as a sleep aid. And I was just wondering, I've tried things like melatonin and tryptophan, and nothing seems to help. So what does she recommend?
Laura, thanks for the call. Now, Michelle, I don't know if you want to recommend particular sleep aids to our caller, but what kind of things should we think about as we explore the sleep aid market to find something that is right for us?
Yeah, Laura, that is a really great question. I mean, there's a lot of older adults that suffer from sleep problems and insomnia, so your problem is not unique to you. Many, many older adults have a similar problem. So the first thing I would do, Laura, is to talk to both either your physician or your pharmacist to make sure that none of the prescription products that you're taking could be the culprit here. It could be that you're taking a medication that is keeping you up, perhaps making you want to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And so that's, you know, waking you up and not letting you go back to sleep. There's a lot of prescription medications as well that could be, you know, contributing to this problem. So let's make sure that there's nothing else that's causing this problem before you medicate for something that could be a different thing that we could address on the prescription or medical side. The second thing that I would tell you is that there are a lot of non-drug options that you could also try, and I'll just list a few off for you. The first thing, of course, is so good sleep hygiene includes things like not exercising late at night, not drinking alcohol late at night, not watching TV in bed, not smoking late in the evening, making sure that you're not eating late at night or drinking caffeinated beverages. So I'll start there. I agree with you that sometimes melatonin is not enough. There are some prescription sleep aids that you can be prescribed as well. And that would be worth a conversation with your doctor about that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura, at 800-642-1234. Now, we've been focusing on the over-the-counter drugs. Michelle, are there prescription medications where people should be particularly careful when they head over to the over-the-counter aisle? Like, if you're taking certain categories of prescriptions, we need to really watch out for possible interactions with the over-the-counter stuff that we might not think about.
Yeah, you know, honestly, there are so many different classes of medications that, you know, I don't want to necessarily say these are all of them and none of the others, mm-hmm. but definitely older adults in particular who have typical older adult disease, chronic diseases like hypertension or blood pressure, glaucoma, some men with prostate issues are a primary issue. As I said with Laura, insomnia tends to be a big problem as well. So those are kind of the areas that should sort of be a red flag for you that you should engage in a conversation with your doctor or your pharmacist to just ensure that either your disease state or your prescriptions that you're taking to address those disease states are not in interaction with the OTCs that might also be solving other problems for you.
One thing that I'm really curious about, Michelle, is, you know, it's not that hard to go online and look for a drug interaction between two things, over the counter or prescription. How much more complicated does it get as we get up to three or four or more medications that someone might be taking at the same time?
Very, very complicated. You know, some of the older adults that we've worked with in our studies are taking 8, 10, 12 prescription medications. And so there's a lot of different ways in which that a medication could cause harm to you. We've looked at over-the-counter medication misuse in a lot of different ways. So the first way that we've looked at that is when older adults are not taking medications that are consistent with the label. Maybe the label might say, take one pill every 6 hours. And we've had older adults tell us, well, you know, does it really need to be 6 hours? I could take it every 4 hours. I could take two every 4 hours. I could take three every 4 hours because they don't recognize the potential for harm. We talked a little bit about drug-drug interactions. We also, there are some products that are also contraindicated in specific disease states. And then lastly, there are some medications like diphenhydramine that are actually contraindicated in older adults. And there are a couple of others as well. So again, lots and lots of complexity there, which is why even though there's an expectation that, you know, consumers can purchase and select OTCs on their own, and particularly for an older adult, it's always good habit to just check with the pharmacist to confirm.
Michelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Michelle Chui is professor and chair of social and administrative sciences and head of the Chui Systems Approach to Medication Safety Lab at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. She talked to us about over-the-counter drug safety in terms of both quality and recalls and possible interactions between over-the-counter medications and other conditions and medications. Tomorrow on Central Time, Election 2024 is just a year away. Election results from states this week plus some early polls are setting the stage for the presidential race. We'll look at the latest news in the campaign. And on Food Friday, it's time for some good soup. We'll get advice and recipes for great soups for the winter months, and you can share your favorites. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.